Hello, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann W. Smith, co-chair with Lynn Curtis of the Club's Arts Forum, which is your program organizer for today. And I'm pleased to welcome Gary Kurtz, chair of the California State Library Foundation, who will introduce our speaker today. Come on. It's on. Gary, thank you.
Thank you, Anne, and I am honored and delighted and very pleased to introduce Dr. Catherine Williamson, one of the great scholars in the book world. And she's joined Bonhams down in Los Angeles in 1997, took over the rare book department there, and she has been involved in the appraisal of some extraordinary collections. It would just make your heart flip many, many times, including a manuscript notebook of George Gershwin from 1929-1931, the James Blanchard Collection of Important Americana, and the Hancock Chase Collection of John Hancock Manuscripts, formerly housed at the National Museum of American History, the Smithsonian. In the fall of 2004, her department sold the Lloyd Ostendorf Collection of Lincolniana, perhaps the most famous collection of Abraham Lincoln material to come to auction in the last decade. Additionally, Dr. Williamson has successfully handled diverse property from the estates of Clara Bow, Tyrone Power, Sarah Vaughan, James Roosevelt, and General H.H. Happ Arnold. And Catherine is a star of stage, screen, and television. She can be seen on national TV all the time, on HDTV as an appraiser, and on Antiques Roadshow. She's done that for over 10 years now. She's a true scholar, written a number of books and articles. She has a doctorate from Louisiana State University. And it gives me a great honor to introduce, again, Dr. Catherine Williamson. And the title of her talk is The Lost, the Found, and the Fake: Highlights from 20 Years in the Book Business. Dr. Williamson.
Well, Gary, I think you took my speech.
Oh. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Here we go.
I forgot to have one advertisement. One of the things I love about Bonhams is that they produce these elegant, very useful catalogs that are just loaded with terrific bibliographic information. So I'd like to compliment your
Thank
department.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Gary. Thank you, Anne and Lynn. It's a great pleasure to be here, both for FABS and for the BCC. As you both said, I'm the director of Fine Books and Manuscripts at Bonhams, which is formerly Bonhams and Butterfields, which was formerly Butterfields, which was formerly Butterfield and Butterfield. Same company. I've lived through all these various rebrandings without ever changing desks. And it's only been 19 years. I rounded up for my title to 20. It's only been 19 years, but feels like 20. My job is to find collectible books and manuscripts, identify and price them, and then sell them to the highest bidder at auction. That's it. The hardest part of the job is finding the property in the first place. No matter how strange or unusual or rare, we usually can figure out what it is and what it might be worth if we just throw enough resources at it. But finding the stuff in the first place is a tricky combination of science and luck. For example, last November, I received an email from a doctor in the South who got my name from the Antiques Roadshow website. I've been on the show a long time, but I don't seem to be very well known. I'm not sure why he wrote to me over the other book appraisers who appear on that show. I've been on the show since 2001, but I only tape two cities per season. I don't get a lot of airtime. Even the hardcore fans who rush the appraisers at the hotel bar after taping have no idea who I am. But it may be that in my Roadshow online biography, I identify myself as a Southerner. I grew up in the South. I went to Louisiana State. If so, this would be the rare case where that actually worked in my favor. As a physician, he had a passing familiarity with Latin, and in his initial email, he was able to tell me that he had found what appeared to be the 1476 Venetian printing of Aristotle's De Animalibus. I'll show you. He sent me a JPEG, but this is what he sent me. So he sent me the JPEG of the first page of the book, which seemed to be exquisitely hand illuminated. And he mentioned that it seemed like it was printed on animal skin. So I skimmed the email, not really absorbing his words. But when I clicked on the JPEG, I thought, huh. So I sent it to my colleague, Christina, in New York for her thoughts, to which she replied,
oh my God. We got on the phone. We were each furiously looking up auction records and references, and she was the first to figure out that it was the first printing of this work, and if it was on vellum, as he suggested, it was one of only two surviving copies. The other one's at the Bibliothèque Nationale. So, without seeming overeager, I wrote him back, saying how interesting his book was, and could he send me pictures of the binding and the interior and the foredge of the book, because I wanted to make sure it was printed on vellum. I wanted to see the cockling. So a very long, 24 hours later, he sent back the pictures, which confirmed that the copy was on vellum and showed that the book was in this handsome 18th century red Morocco binding. There it is. Featuring an elaborate gilt coat of arms. And Christine and I got even more excited by this. And when he finally sent me a phone number, I set up a time to chat with him. So the Diana Malibus, for those of you who don't remember, is the earliest work known of comprehensive natural history written from the perspective of the impartial observer. In it, Aristotle describes anatomy in a manner that suggests he was using dissection, and he made important observations, particularly on embryology, which are still accurate today, i.e., he said that sharks give birth to live young. It's not surprising that this work would be one of the earliest scientific texts printed, and in fact, it is the earliest comprehensive work of biology in print. This copy had many distinguished owners, including the great bibliophile William Masterman Sykes. The coat of arms is. While it was in Masterman Sykes' collection, it was seen by Thomas Dibden, the great bibliographer, who notes about this very copy in his bibliographical Decameron, "This is the most exquisite specimen of an early Venetian vellum book that I have ever seen." But we didn't know all that yet. We just knew we wanted to know more. So in my first phone conversation with the owner, I asked him, "How did you come to have a Venetian incunable in your small southern town?" And he told me that it had been given as a gift to an ancestor sometime in the early to mid-20th century, and it had been around as long as any living member of the family could remember. And so I also asked, as we do on the roadshow, whether he'd ever had it appraised. And he said that in the 60s, the family had reached out to a librarian about the value, and she'd quoted a price of $300, which somebody had dutifully penciled on the inside cover of the book. So the ancestors settled in this little town in the South where these people lived in the 1970s. And when the last member of the preceding generation died, the family shut up the house with all of its contents in it, including the Aristotle. And there it sat for more than 10 years until another relative announced that he wanted to move into the old family home. So while the doctor and his wife were cleaning out the place, he came across the Aristotle, took out his phone, snapped a picture, and sent it to me. So my colleague Christina quickly flew down to see the book in person and get it and bring it back to New York. I'm in California, she's in New York. It was very hard for either one of us to get to the, we both had to make complicated connections to get to this little town, but it was slightly easier for her. So she went. Once it was in-house, Christina went to the Morgan, went to the Grolier Club, checked the Art Loss Registry, learned more and more wonderful things about this amazing book. And then we came to the point where we had to come up with an estimate. We went back and forth, but we ultimately landed on $300,000 to $500,000, which is big enough to convey the importance of this piece, but hopefully low enough and attractive enough to bring the maximum number of bidders to auction. We began a six-month advertising campaign, toured the book to London, California, and beyond, and finally offered it just last week. Thank goodness I have good news to report, as the cover lot in our June fine sale. And when this book that was in the abandoned house for more than 10 years, finally went under the hammer, the lot sold for $941,000. So that's a lucky find. I love stories of the extraordinary rediscovery. I mean, that's kind of the thing that fuels the roadshow and our business, too. It's the road apple that falls off on the way to market, only to turn up later to surprise and delight the world. But I can tell you, not everything that is lost turns up again. A few years back, a colleague, I'll show you a picture of this, asked me to look something up in my exemplar files, which are pretty much as they were when I started back in 1997. They're a mishmash of photocopies of handwriting samples filed by the author's name. While I was digging around, I found a big file of photocopies from the very first lead my old boss handed me when I took over the department in 1999, an archive of Albert Einstein documents. The collection included 15 manuscripts and 33 letters from Albert Einstein to another physicist, a former student, written from 1933 to 1954 and expressing some doubt about his search for the unified field theory. My former boss, who'd been hired away by a competitor, was ethically bound to leave any Butterfield's leads with his successor, though I quickly realized the reason he'd left this one wasn't because it wasn't really a lead anymore. The very first call I made as the newly minted director of fine books and manuscripts at Butterfield & Butterfield was to the heir of these Einstein papers. I remember this so vividly, sitting down at my desk, naively confident in my own completely untested abilities, full of excitement at the nature of this property that my predecessor had quoted $300,000 to $500,000 on this, which was a very large sum for a book department to handle in 1999. But I barely had a chance to introduce myself before the voice on the other line shouted me down, demanding that my company stop harassing him and vowing to never do business with us again, period. Ouch. Greg had obviously called him one too many times, chasing this lead. I still remember the way my face burned with shame as I hung up the phone. I don't believe anybody had ever spoken to me professionally in such a harsh tone before. Now, of course, people yell at me all the time. It's not a big deal. But then it was new and it was awful. So I waited a couple of months, I think about 3 or 4 months. I called him again. He was still angry. So I apologized, I hung up, and I never called him again. So over the years, that collection would cross my mind, but I never heard what happened to it. So on that morning, when I stumbled upon the copies in my file, I decided to find out. The first thing I did was check the auction records. I looked up the name of the correspondent, the dates of the letters, nothing. Next, I turned to Google, and of course, there it was. It turned out the son of the physicist did offer the manuscripts for sale, but just not at auction. He gave them to a well-respected book dealer who took them to the 2006 London Antiquarian Book Fair. This article, this is, I think, The Guardian, announces the availability of the Einstein papers, and it goes to great pains to explain that the family has rejected the auction path because the manuscripts would have been broken up for sale, which isn't true, but whatever. The dealer who's quoted in the article mentions a near sale to the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, but talks had fallen through. And the asking price here is $1.5 million U.S., which is not unreasonable today. It was sort of high for 2006, very high for 1999. So I read that. And then the next time that these papers made the news, which was actually the first thing that came up in my Google search, was this. I'll let you read that. Einstein's papers burned in fire started by SJB woman. Yikes, right? Ugh, they didn't sell in London. The son, the same guy who was so mean to me, took them back to his cabin in the woods near San Jose, where they burned along with all the rest of his possessions in the 2007 Lick Fire. The follow-up articles on this story mentioned that he's suing the woman who started the fire, but as of yet, that has not been settled. So you can sell too soon, but then again, you can sell too late. All right, let's change that. I know that's depressing. That's a fake. You know that too. That's a facsimile. You know that. If you don't inherit a treasure from your ancestors, your next best bet is to try to turn something up at a flea market, an estate sale, a storage locker auction, one of the many ways the contents of a life are released back into the marketplace. Lots of people make their living doing this, but the chances that you will find a 6 or 7 figure item are pretty slim, but that doesn't stop everybody from trying. So this, I'm sure you know, this is this facsimile edition of the Gettysburg Address. It's one of their many of them. About once a week, I get a call or an email from somebody who has either this or the Declaration of Independence. And since the discovery in the late 80s of a copy of the Dunlop Declaration hidden in an old frame, which has sold publicly for as much as $8 million and is rumored to have sold privately recently for many times that amount, everyone wants to find a declaration or some other foundational document of American history. Unfortunately for me, there are thousands and probably millions of facsimile copies of these floating around. The Declaration, the Constitution, Gettysburg Address, and also the Articles of Confederation, but nobody ever calls about that. They're just like, what's this? Throw it away. And they call about the other ones. And so I can dismiss most of these queries by asking if the document is, if it's like 60 by 20 inches, if it's small, if it's brown and crumbling. If you've seen them, you know they look like used coffee filters left out in the sun to dry. And if it has any of those markings, no, it's a facsimile. It has no collectible value. But, you know, the truth is I want to find a foundational document just as much as the next person. It's just as exciting to me, maybe more so, to find that lost piece of the historical puzzle. Which is why when I was approached over 10 years ago by someone who showed me what he claimed was a lost copy of the Gettysburg Address, the very one Lincoln read from, I didn't immediately show him the door. So many of you may know this already, but to refresh, there are 5 known copies of the Gettysburg Address in Lincoln's hand. There's the Nicolay copy, which is at the Library of Congress, which is probably the first draft given to John Nicolay, his secretary. There's the Hay copy, which some say is the second draft. Some say is the one he might be the one he read from, or it's a fair copy produced when he returned to D.C. John Hay was the other assistant. And then there are 3 fair copies produced after the delivery of the speech: the Edward Everett copy, the George Bancroft copy, and the Bliss copy, which is the one that one is hanging in the Lincoln bedroom at the White House. So the Nicolay and the Hay copy supposedly precede the delivery of the speech, and the other 3 are fair copies afterwards. So the Hay copy might be the one he read from, but eyewitness accounts at the time of the speech claim that Lincoln pulled a folded piece of paper out of his pocket and read from it, and the Hay copy does not have any folds, nor do any of the others. So if those eyewitness accounts are true, what happened to the copy that he actually read from? So, tucked away in the Lincoln papers at the Library of Congress is a letter to Lincoln from David Wills. David Wills was a Gettysburg attorney who originally invited Lincoln to speak at the dedication ceremonies and who hosted the president while he was in town. Wills writes, he writes on November 23rd, this is 4 days after the ceremony, he writes, "On behalf of the states represented here, I request of you the original manuscript of the dedicatory remarks delivered by you here last Thursday. We desire them to be placed with the correspondence and other papers connected with the project." So here's a very specific request, really seemingly for the copy you read from, for our records. But in Lincoln's paper, there is no record of his response, and there's no record of Judge Wills or the cemetery getting a copy either. So, this is very interesting. Fast forward to 1990, when an Ohio man claimed to have found the David Wills copy, or at least the second page of it, inside an 1865 book titled The Lincoln Memorial. I'll show you a picture. The manuscript was on the distinctive blue paper that Lincoln often used, appeared to be in his hand and was docketed on the verso for Honorable Judge David Wills from A. Lincoln, November 19th, 1863. So this is the one that came across my desk. So I was like, oh, this is very, very interesting. Wow, it seems like a lost piece of history recovered at an Ohio flea market. In 1990, this story made headlines in the hometown paper, and the piece seemed to be headed for a high-profile New York City auction that fall. But the fall sales came and went, and the piece never showed up at auction. The Judge Wills copy came to my attention in the mid-2000s. It still had its champions and its detractors, and at that time it had a new agent who really believed in it. I saw the press from the 90s, but I also knew that if the specialist quoted in that story had thought the piece was real, he would have sold it. However, sometimes pieces get an unfair reputation. Sometimes there's a rush to judgment, or the technology is insufficient to prove or discount, or people just can't resolve the matter, so they throw up their hands and they walk away. So when it came across my desk, I had to investigate. If it turned out to be right, however, it would have to be 150% right to beat back the innuendo from 15 years earlier. So, interestingly, the Wills copy contains just page 2 of the Gettysburg Address, not the full piece. So the first task is to compare it side by side with the Hay and the Nicolay copies, which I think I have here. So on the your left, as you're looking at it, that's the Hay copy. This is the Judge Wills copy. It's a close match. To the naked eye, the handwriting, the paper look right, and this one. Wait, let me back it up. This one you can see it has the folds, right? It has the folds that supposedly were there, but when we looked a little bit closer, it gave us pause. So the fourth line from the bottom here,
1, 2, 3, 4,
has this edit under God, which appears in the later fair copy versions. Does not appear in version 1, does not appear in this one, in the Hay copy, which sort of complicates the priority. Either, if it is the one he read from, it should precede this one, right? So it shouldn't have an edit that doesn't show up in this copy. I mean, there's some arguments. You could sort of argue around that, but that was the first thing that gave us pause. The second is that Judge Wills did not become a judge until 1871. Oops. Then we put a black light under it and it fluoresced, indicating that it had likely been treated with a chemical substance. Not good, right? And then finally, when we made a transparency of this copy to place on top of that one. And while it was not an exact match when you put the two on top, if you did it line by line, that it was a close enough match to indicate that it was probably traced. And probably the biggest tell is this one.
So this deletion here.
So it's a deletion by Lincoln here.
That
is just a blank space here.
But look how short the next word is, right?
If Lincoln had really been writing in a proper flow, he would have put the.
He would have moved that letter
up. Any one of these would have been enough to give you pause, but at that point we're like, okay, this is not right. This forger has used the strategy of Mark Hoffman, who's the Mormon forger, who often created documents that could have existed, did exist, maybe don't, or could have existed, but had never, were no longer known. But Hoffman was in prison for 5 years by the time this one popped up. So I don't know that he did it. It's probably a copycat, a forger. So for the second time in its life, you know, this document has been debunked. I don't really deserve a lot of credit because I wasn't the first one. The people 15 years before me figured it out. I just kind of replicated the experiment to confirm the results. But this is not to say that I've never uncovered a nation's foundational documents and offered them at auction. I have. They just weren't American documents. They were Chinese. In 2011, one of the pickers who regularly supplies the California and Western painting sales stopped by my desk on his way to see another appraiser. He asked me, "What do you think of Mao?" And I said, "Mao Zedong? What do you mean, what do I think of Mao?" He said, "Would you be interested in Mao papers?" And now at that point, Mao might have been the only name from 20th century Chinese history that I recognized. I knew very little else. But I did know that the Chinese art market was blowing up around the world, that our Asian art department was having auctions that did 10, 20 times their low estimates, and they had so much property coming in, there was a minimum wait time of 6 months to a year for property to sell. So I said, sure, I'm interested. And he told me to research something called the Xian incident on the internet, and he would call me later. The Xian incident, which is such a polite and probably incorrectly translated name, refers to this moment before World War II when the warring communists and nationalist armies in China came together to negotiate an unofficial truce so that they could stop fighting each other and repel the invading Japanese forces that were coming in through Manchuria. The figure at the center of the Xian incident was a young Manchurian warlord named Zhang Zhulang, known as the Young Marshal, who, after the assassination of his father by the Japanese, embraced Chiang Kai-shek and the nationalist movement in the hope of reunifying China. Chinese should not fight Chinese, he famously said. Chiang Kai-shek, however, believed that the communist forces led by Mao were a greater threat to him than the Japanese. And he was actually probably right about that. And he later directed his lieutenants, including this guy, Zhang Zhulang, into battle against them. So this is the backdrop of the Xian incident. So in the spring of 1936, the young marshal secretly met with Mao's lieutenant Zhu Enlai to negotiate an end to the hostilities between the communists and the nationalists. No peace came out of that meeting. The young marshal made it clear that Chiang Kai-shek was fully in control of the nationalist army, and any peace negotiations would have to include him. But Chiang Kai-shek continued to step up hostilities against communist forces, grew suspicious of the young marshal's lack of progress. So in December of 1936, Chiang Kai-shek flew to Xi'an, which is kind of in the center of the country, where the young marshal was stationed to lead an attack on nearby communist forces. The young marshal and another officer tried to convince their leader to join forces with the communists, but when Chiang refused, they kidnapped him, kept him under house arrest, and brought in the communist delegation, which included Mao Zedong, to negotiate. Chiang Kai-shek refused to participate for several days until it was clear his life was at stake. So he did ultimately engage in some negotiations. No peace treaty was signed, but afterwards the two sides ceased fighting each other, allowing for the successful resistance to Japan. So that is such a pivotal moment in modern Chinese history. So after the incident, the young marshal was arrested, tried in a military court, sentenced to 10 years for his part, though he wound up spending more than 50 years under house arrest till 1989. Today, he's a hero to modern China. And the Xian incident is a pivotal historical moment. It's like Lexington and Concord or the signing of a declaration. It's this moment of unification for China instead of this large body of small nation states. You know, it's this pivotal moment that leads to kind of reunification. So this is a lot of backstory, I know. Sorry. In the young marshal's entourage was a young American, this guy named Highland Bud Lyon. He's a handsome fellow, right? He looks like a movie star. He was an actor. He was an actor, a Hollywood stuntman, a race car driver, and an auto mechanic. This is his, that's his headshot from his acting career. He's a comedian and a musician and a little bit of everything. He left Southern California in 1934 to follow a showgirl, this lady, to China. He was not successful with the showgirl, but he landed in China and landed a job as an airplane mechanic at the China National Air Corporation, where he met the young marshal when the latter ordered a Boeing aircraft from the United States and the plane arrived disassembled. This is Bud Lyon trying to put together the boat. He put it together. It did fly. After putting the Boeing together, Lyon signed off as chief mechanic, and he became a trusted member of the young marshal's inner circle. He was also never without a camera and amassed an impressive collection of photography of China from his years there. He was in Xi'an during the incident. I think I have some pictures of some of his. Oh, no, that's not. During the incident, and for 5 years afterward, he served as a personal bodyguard to the young marshal's wife and family. He left China in 1941. Returning to Los Angeles with six steamer trunks full of his personal collection of photography and a small lockbox of documents. When he returned, he settled into a more mundane life, working as an auto mechanic and marrying a dancer, a different one. He died in 1973. His widow died in 2001. And for nearly 10 years, her heirs held on to the trunks. At one point, they invited a major library to come take a look, but they decided not to sell. Then they came across the path of our picker, a very savvy man who also knew the Asian market was strong and who liked what he saw. What was in the 6 steamer trunks? We had to hire a translator to find out, but among other things, we found an April 1936 letter from Mao to the young marshal outlining a roadmap for peace between the communists and the nationalists. We found an August 1936 letter from the Chinese Communist Party to the young marshal outlining the plans for the next 3 months, and complete this page. That's a list of code names for members of the CCP and the nationalist operatives. This is a very exciting spy letter. We also found 2 copies of a draft peace agreement between the communists and the nationalists, both signed by Mao, signed them with the stamp, and with a space left blank for Chiang Kai-shek's signature, which he'd never signed. A small diary of the young marshals, which contained his farewell address to his family. This is written after the incident, once he's been taken into custody. And then finally, Bud Lyon's extensive archive of photos, correspondence, and memorabilia from 1934 to 1941. He took massive, massive amounts of photos, and he actually put them into albums. He kind of organized things chronologically in albums. He must have done this back in the States, with typed labels identifying everybody in the picture. It's just an amazing archive. When I first met with the family, I was very impressed by the collection, but it looked like trouble. There was the possibility of a title challenge from the young marshal's family or descendants. It was unclear whether the Chinese government would try to seize the documents, in which case our attorney didn't have much faith we'd be able to fight that very well. Also, the Asian Art Department at Bonhams, whose help I would need if I had any chance of getting this collection in front of the right people, was worried that the sale of the collection might be received negatively and affect their business in China. There were lots and lots of reasons to pass on this deal. I told the family first they had to get their title issues in order. It took 2 years, but they did reach an agreement with the descendants of the young marshal. Then I had to convince the Asian Art Department that our narrative would not be that Bud Lyon was a pillaging Westerner, but that he was a careful steward of history, saving this archive from the ravages of war, which in fact he was. And finally, I had to explain to the consigners the risks involved from China. And if they come after this, I don't know what we're going to be able to do about it. But the family really, really, really wanted to have a public auction because they wanted the world to know about Bud Lyon and his place in history. That almost never happens. Usually when you tell people all these scary things, they're like, oh, never mind. I don't want to do it. But these people, they were like, no, let's do it. Let's go for it. So we went for it. It took forever, but finally everyone at Bonhams from the top down said go for it. We had to hurry to get it on the calendar for the New York Asia Week of 2013. Translations and cataloging had to be finished, items photographed, the catalog designed and mailed, ads scheduled, press orchestrated. We sent a few highlights to Hong Kong to preview with the other Asian art sales, though we only sent copies of the important letters and a small percentage of the photographs on the outside chance a problem cropped up. During the preview in New York City, I was completely reliant on one young Asian art appraiser who acted as interpreter and client liaison for me. We were shoved into an alcove under the stairs outside the galleries because the galleries were filled with Asian art, which is the 800-pound gorilla at Bonhams. But so we were in this tiny little alcove, but everyone had to walk by us to get to the other previews. So one way or another, we saw the people we needed to see. But still, the morning of the sale, I was very nervous There were only 30 registrants, which is a terrifyingly small number, even if you consider that there were only 8 lots in the sale. There were phone bidders lined up on every lot, which Christina pointed out to me was a good sign, but some were well-known to the Asian Art Department for cutthroat lowballing, and others were completely new, which is even scarier. The Chinese media wanted to be in the room for the sale, but we didn't know if that was a good sign or a bad sign, so we made them wait in the lobby. Then the sale began. My boss, the lead auctioneer, wanted more than just the auction sheets normally generated for a sale. He wanted a script with every name written out phonetically and in large print, which I raced to finish before the sale began. The sale began at noon, an hour before the Chinese painting sale was to begin. The room was foolish, but most of the attendees were looky-loos waiting for the afternoon sale that was supposed to coming up at 1. The first item, the young marshal's personal phone book with his ownership signature, opened at a low price and stalled at around half the low estimate. Yikes, not a good sign, I thought, feeling the creep of flop sweat. Well, at least this'll go fast. I'll be out the door on my way to the airport before 1, I thought. But then an online bidder jumped in, and just like that, bidding took off. And before the lot hammered down at $19,000 against a presale estimate of $6,000 to $8,000. The second lot was the Roadmap to Peace letter, which is this one, which we had priced at $200,000 to $300,000. The signature here is secretarial, which is not unusual in Chinese tradition, as the stamp is more important than the human signature. I put a big price on this piece because I felt like it was significant, but while I liked this and responded to it, it didn't seem like the people previewing sparked to it in the same way. The bidding began slowly again, climbed more steadily this time, landing at $380,000, which is good. That was good. That was a good response. The next lot, which I think the next lot was this one, which we had in at $150,000 to $200,000. This one doubled its low estimate, selling at $300,000. That's good. That's great. The fifth lot was the draft peace agreement, signed by Mao, the original and the carbon. I had put $300,000 to $500,000 on this, and I thought this would be the star lot of the sale. This is the thing that almost was, right? The piece that almost happened but didn't. And again, bidding was very slow, very, very slow, and it sold for $420,000 against a pre-sale estimate of $300,000 to $500,000. Not bad, not bad. So we were 35 minutes in. It was a very slow, excruciatingly slow sale. And we were hovering at around $1 million hammer against a pre-sale low estimate of $800,000, which is good, and that's the critical measurement of success at auction. The family would be happy. The suits would be happy. Asian art would be happy that we hadn't bombed on their doorstep. And then lot 6 came up. The young marshal's farewell messages to his family and the country. During his long imprisonment and final years, the young marshal almost never spoke of the Xian incident, claiming his role was not to be celebrated or remembered and that he was ashamed of what he had done. But here were 8 pages in his hand that, in addition to describing his motives and his hopes for the country and his family, also revealed his intention to kill himself upon landing before going into prison. Very dramatic stuff. Far away, the most popular item during preview, the one that elicited the most reverential responses. People would hold it, you know, very reverentially during the preview. We had put this in at $40,000 to $60,000, which I thought was a lot. But after a solid 10 minutes of bidding, which is a very long time in the auction world, it hammered at $710,000. The photo archive also blew past its original estimate of $50,000 to $70,000, selling for $400,000. In total, the day's take was over $2.7 million, including premium. A rousing success and my first white glove sale, which is what we call an auction in which every lot sells. There are only 8 lots, so it's not that impressive, but it's the only time it's ever happened for me. So there you have it. The lost, the found, the forged, the foundational, just a little bit of the things that have come across my desk in the past 2 decades. Thank you for letting me speak today. It's been a real pleasure. If you'd like me to come back and tell you more stories, happy to do it at your leisure. Thank you. And do you have questions? You opening up for questions? Sure. Oh, okay, great. I know, I should be able to. What does an auction house do to help promote the sale and maximize the price of ordinary non-dramatic consignments? That's a great question. You're right. When there's a process before every sale, which includes not just advertising, but public relations as well. And usually for the PR side, we pick the things that we think are going to get picked up in the press. So the Aristotle had a lot of run in the press. The Mao papers had a lot of run in the Chinese media, not so much in the States. The still great but more mundane stuff is targeted towards the buyer base, right? That we know who a lot of you are, collectors, right? You get emails from us all the time, emails and flyers and catalogs. So, let's say I have a lovely collection of fine press books, or I've got Dickens, or I've got, something that is not going to get picked up by the media, but is going to appeal to our buyer base. So first of all, I drill down into my database and find the people that I know collect Charles Dickens. And not only do those people get a catalog, but they also probably get a call. They probably get a call from me or from one of my colleagues to say, hey, did you get that catalog? Hey, do you have any questions? Hey, would you like photographs? Or do you want to make sure that you are free on the preview so you can come in and see? So it really works on two levels. You know, the high profile stuff, we do a bigger social media campaign, but the more prosaic stuff, the stuff that's loved by the smaller but more dedicated group, that's old school. Pounding the pavement, working the phones.
We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to Arts Forum speaker Dr. Catherine Williamson.
Okay. So another question, who pays the reserve? The family? The reserve is a number that is agreed upon between the auction house and the consignor, the owner. In other words, it's the minimum amount that must be bid before the piece is sold. If bidding doesn't reach the reserve, that piece still belongs to the consignor. We don't sell it. Assuming bidding makes the reserve, so it's a threshold, really. The person who pays the reserve is the buyer if he or she actually bids to that amount or beyond. But it's a threshold. There's a number at which, for both the buyer and the seller, there's a number at which they're comfortable selling, right? If it sells for less than this, I will feel sick. So just above that is your reserve. For the buyer, there's a price at which if I pay more than this, I will be sick. Okay, that's your ceiling. It's that simple. So that's what a reserve is. Okay, this one, Biomedical Library and the Huntington, the residual was sold to someone. No one seems to know who this was, and no one seems to know what happened to the many volumes of the Bulletin of the Johns Hopkins Hospital Suite, 1892. Any knowledge or thoughts? So a donation was made to the Huntington, and then they sold off a part of it. Is that you want to know if I know anything about that?
Yeah.
I don't. But I do know that that is not uncommon. That is not uncommon that when libraries, museums are given donations, particularly if things are duplicate what's already in their collection, that they will make choices. They will keep the better things, and they might sell things that are duplicates or are out of area. I didn't sell. We did not liquidate for either of these, but it's not unusual for that to happen. It's hard to know. Sometimes the institutions use auction houses, in which case you might be able to track it on the auction records. But a lot of times they don't. If they do, they don't give use of name. So it's hard. You have to know exactly which book you're looking for, right? I'm looking for that Newton optics, right? And you have to know which copy it is to be able to track it. Because if they don't let you do use of name, if they don't let us talk specific, so sometimes we'll have to say there's just a library stamp without saying the accession from which library, because they won't let us use their name. So you have to go in person and look at the book. And then, of course, you'll figure out, oh, this is from this was in the Huntington or wherever. Not that I have not sold books for the Huntington, but it's very hard. I agree, it's very hard to track in that situation. Are there other? I think those are my, that's what I have here. You have another? When competing with, say, Sotheby's and Christie's for high-end items, how do you persuade the consignor that Bonhams will meet their needs more successfully? Well, that's hard. That's obviously their big competition. The two of them do kind of own the bulk of the marketplace. I have to say my team is, we have developed an expertise in the unusual. I don't think anybody else would have taken on these Mao papers. It was so much work. It was so hard. And it was such a brutal slog. It was really great once we actually sold it, but it was really, 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 really hard. And nobody really knew what they were worth, or would anybody even. The Asian art department kept telling me, our clients don't like paper. They collect art and beautiful things, but they don't like paper. So one of the ways that we compete against them is, we'll take on a slightly harder project. And two is we try harder. We've got a really crack team. I've got three or four specialists in New York. I've got Adam here in San Francisco, and I'm down in Los Angeles. It's a young team. I'm the oldest person by a lot, and really, really hardworking, really, really hardworking team. So yes, we don't get in the door on the $10 million collections, but in the last, since I would say, when was American Experience, Adam? Was that 2010? 2010. Since 2010. In 2010, we sold a collection for Bruce McKinney, who many of you know. Probably he's heads up the Rare Book Hub, and he's a big figure in collecting. And it was his American Lit collection. And he, he was very, he had this tremendous collection. It priced out to about $2.5 million. It was a collection that anybody would want, and we were competing with everybody, not just above us, but below us too, to get this collection. And he said he had all these things that he wanted, and he wanted specific terms, and he wanted a sale in New York. He wanted online bidding, which not everybody was doing at that time, and he wanted a series. He wanted us to produce a series of videos on book collecting. And he had a whole idea. He had a script of what he wanted to do. And we looked at each other and we were like, okay, that sounds great. I'd love to do all of that stuff. And we were the only people who said, okay, we'll try that. That sounds great. And so we did. And he was right about everything. He wanted to, one of the things he did in his catalog was he wanted to list what he'd originally paid for the book and where he bought it, even if our price was lower than what he had originally paid for it. And we were like, okay, we'll do it. People are going to be mad, but we'll do it. And people were mad. They were very mad about that. But it was kind of great because it showed you, it was this really great experiment. You could see what parts of the market had really exploded and what parts had flattened. which is not always something you can tell, right, just by looking at auction records. So that was amazing to do. And that really changed things for us. First of all, getting that collection, it was $2.5 million, but I think it hammered it like four, right? It just did gangbusters. And it made us competitive for the $1 million to $2 million collection, all of which had we were sometime rarely getting some of those before, but we're getting an awful lot of those now, and that has really changed things. And I'm happy with if you give me $800,000 to $1 million, I can do something with that. That's great. And unfortunately, Christie's and Sotheby's have sort of moved to this place where they can do a little bit, but they can't do the separate catalog anymore. They can't do as much with the smaller ones. They're focused on the $5 to $10 million collection. So it's helped us really kind of get into this niche where as everybody knows, and there are a lot of great books that are not super expensive, but they're beautiful and they're desirable and people want them, and we want to sell them too. Yes.
Okay. Catherine, great presentation. That's really, really terrific. That's
great.
This is a little more personal question, actually, a little bit. Obviously, if you take an item and it sells quite a bit larger than what you had originally ballparked it, great for the owner, great for the auction house, everyone's really good. At what point, if that happens, consistently, it goes over, significantly over, from an appraiser standpoint, sort of a professional appraiser standpoint, do you look at yourself or do you get looked at and say, you're sort of lowballing these quite a lot, So it's great news, everyone believes us. But at what point does that happen, or is there a consistency that's down below, you don't worry about it?
Well, it depends upon what it is. I mean, there's some things like, everybody knows what a stone declaration ought to, if you seriously underprice something that all of us agree should be $100,000 and you put $20,000 on it just because it came from an estate and you can do or whatever, you're not doing a service to that piece because everybody's going to think there's something wrong with it if you price it way too low. This stuff, we didn't have any, I didn't know. There was no record of any of this stuff. So I don't feel bad about this, and I don't feel bad about that Aristotle either, because there was nothing had come up in 50 years for that one. But yeah, it can. You don't want to lowball the things. I mean, things have a value. It's funny. My feeling about this has evolved over the decades, because when I started, the mandate is sell it. Sell it, sell it, sell it. You need to put a price on it that it sells, which is true. We do need to do that. But now that more and more private clients are bidding at auction, which didn't used to happen 20 years ago, people who aren't working with an expert or they're new to the auction business, they are looking to that estimate for guidance, right? I thought you said I could get it for between $3,000 and $5,000. What do you mean it sold for $10,000? So if we really underprice everything, we kind of do a disservice to those people who are clients that we want to cultivate and encourage. So we have conversations about it. It's an art. It's not a science. We talk about this every day. What do you want to put on that? What do you think about this? So I think, and some people are, let's be more aggressive, and other people are, no, I just want to sell it. So yeah, it's something we think about every day. I got a new one here. What is the seller charge if an item doesn't meet reserve? We do, if we have put an item in auction and it goes through the whole process, it's been photographed, it's been cataloged, it's probably moved from city to city. So we have already incurred some expenses. So we do usually charge a small fee to try and get some of those back. We usually ask that people at least pay to the insurance fee, which is a small percentage of the reserve. What we usually do, though, is just ask to try it again. Like, oh, we didn't sell it this time. I'm so sorry. Can we try it again in the September sale? I think it'll do better. Maybe we'll edge the estimate down just a little bit. We'll try it again. You don't pay double fees. You pay the same fee. Let's try it again. Let's see if we can sell it for you. If you take it back, you say, nope, I'm done with you people. I'm taking it back. We do ask that you pay a little bit for our troubles.
I'd like to shift gears a little bit and go to your Antiques Roadshow experience.
Okay.
And I'm always, I don't know why I'm amazed, but when people are astounded at their bountiful estimates, but always say, oh, no, no, but it's personal, it's family, I'd never sell it. Do you know, is there any tracking of how many things actually get sold?
Bring up at auction?
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like if you came to ask about what it's worth, some part of you wants to sell it. Like, if it's enough money, you might want to sell it. No, they don't, because they are very clear. You know, the roadshow, unlike other reality TV, it has very clear rules for the behavior of the specialists. And when any specialist violates it, man, they just come down like a hammer. And one of their rules is no business getting there, guys. For the 50 or 70, however many appraisers are there, you guys are not here to do business. You're just here to appraise. So we sit at this big circle. They rent a civic center. They set up this big round of tables, and each department is at a table. I'm at the book table. Musical instruments is over here. Jewelry's over here, like all the other ones. We get to tape our business card down to the table so people can say, oh, you're Catherine. And then there's a table on the way out. You can leave marketing supplies if you want. If you want to leave your business card, I stopped doing it because I just felt like it was a waste. Nobody ever did that. They just get it from the web. But if you want to leave marketing material, you can do that. But you are not, even if you see something great, you're not to say, sell that with me. You can say something like, if you ever decide you'd like to sell it, my information can be found on the blah, blah, blah. But you can't really do it. So it's impossible to track. I know some things have popped out. I've probably gotten, you know, it's not that the people on the show sell with me. 10 years ago, I did a Folio McKinney Hall appraisal. Almost didn't film it, even though it was this big, beautiful $70,000 book, because the guy seemed kind of drunk, and they're like, we don't put drunk people on TV. But he pulled it together. He just pulled it together for the taping. And that runs every now and then. And every single time that runs, somebody calls me either with – they've never had the full three-volume set of McKinney and Hall, but a lot of the Octavo sets have sold probably 8 or 10 sets of the Octavo. Those are $10,000 books. That's pretty good. And then some single volumes of the folios. So that's really, for me, that's how that keeps giving back. If you can tape a good appraisal of something high value, but that is not that rare, you pay for your trip. Okay. One more? Okay.
One very quick question. One moment. Wait a moment, please. Wait a moment, please.
I just wondered if you know what happened ultimately to the young marshal.
I do. So he, when after World War II, when the Chinese, when the communists and the nationalists resumed fighting, and when Chiang Kai-shek went to Taiwan, he plucked the young marshal out of prison and took him with him to Taiwan, where he set him up under house arrest, and he was under house arrest until 1989, when he was 80-something years old. And then he lived to be over 100. And so he spent his final years traveling. Like, he went to Hawaii. He might have actually moved to Hawaii for a little bit. But it was a fairly pleasant house arrest. He apparently studied art and music, and everybody came to see him. If you were in Taiwan, you went to see the young marshal. His house became this elegant salon, but he didn't leave it until 1989.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for those wonderful,
you're welcome,
and enlightening stories, Catherine. Let's hear it for. So we do thank you for your delightful presentation here today. We also thank our audiences here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 114th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.